This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Ed Feigenbaum is the creator and the editor of the Indiana Gaming Insight and the Indiana Legislative Insight newsletters published by the Hanna News Service. And he joins us from time to time to bring us updates on how the casinos, not only the local ones, but all across the state, are doing these days. And as always, Ed, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, appreciate you having me on, Chris.
Well, how are we doing as far as the latest reports from the Indiana Gaming Commission are concerned on how the casino revenues have been shaping up lately?
Well, it was a real good month in May, as I think everybody in the region realizes. You know, you had a lot more bright lights in the sky there on I-94, I guess, off of Burr Street, mm-hmm. lighting up the skies with the big lights there at the new Hard Rock Casino, Northern Indiana. And let me tell you, they kind of lit up the state turnstiles too, and the revenue count. It was a very good month, and it was a good month not only for Hard Rock in their 2.5 weeks of opening, but also for the other casinos as well. It looks like we're not necessarily cannibalizing things early on, but we're starting to look at perhaps a market expansion. But don't quote me on that because it's way too early to tell.
And
there are just so many other variables that are at stake right now, Chris. You know, everybody kind of looked at the $20.5 million that Hard Rock generated in the 2 weeks or so that they were open, and said, "Oh, wow, that's just incredible! You know, you double that, and that's $40 million that they'd probably be bringing in during the month, and that's more than we've seen from Horseshoe Casino Hammond in a long time, and that would give them, you know, the top rank and everything." Well, you can't be quite that glib about things. That's not necessarily the way that things work, because you have to realize that there were 2 weeks, the first 2 weeks of March, you had the two Majestic Star casinos at Buffington Harbor totally dark. So there were two fewer properties in play during that first half of March, and players obviously are going to gravitate toward some other casinos. So there was a little bit of pent-up demand there, either from people who went to a Horseshoe or Ameristar or perhaps one of the other Chicagoland casinos, Blue Chip, whatever, in those first 2 weeks. And then there may have been others that said, okay, well, I would have ordinarily gambled at Majestic Star, but they've been closed the last 2 weeks of April and the first 2 weeks of May, and I want to gamble. I'm going to try out this new Hard Rock Casino. And then you also had what was effectively, you know, the first full month of no pandemic restrictions at the casinos. You didn't have the same kind of mask restrictions that you had, the same kind of social distancing and smoking restrictions, the eating and drinking on the casino floor that we had restricted over the last few months, the social distancing. You know, you've got more of an ability to be sociable again at the table game. So a lot of people were just kind of breathing a sigh of relief and saying, okay, I'm going to go back to the casinos now and you know, we don't have to deal with all these strange restrictions. And at the same time, as you well know, you know, you don't have movie theaters that are open, so your entertainment options may be limited. You know, if you're a big sports fan looking to try and catch some of the excitement from the Cubs and the first place White Sox, you also had capacity limited sports stadiums in Chicago. You don't have the venue open at Horseshoe Casino Hammond. You don't have the Holiday Star Theater anymore for concerts. You're not going to see any kind of real indoor concerts for a while. So people really had no other major entertainment options. And as a result, they were perhaps flocking to the casinos in greater numbers than we might have seen. But on the flip side, certainly the opening of the Hard Rock Casino Northern Indiana regenerated some kind of interest in all the casinos. The tremendous property that they've got there, the great offerings, the ability that they had to staff up so quickly, you know, really attracted patrons and excited patrons. You know, any kind of new property in an area is going to generate, you know, what we call the tire kickers. They're going to come in to see, you know, the new kid on the block. And
right.
Everybody wants to check it out, but you know, then again, you typically don't see the same kind of as the casinos call them, rated players. You know, the kind of players that they know, that they've marketed to, that they know what kind of levels of play that they're going to generate, and they're not the higher value kinds of patrons, the initial folks that are kind of just checking out the property, and so you're going to see a lower win per patron from those people, or at least a lower volume. You may see a higher win from them in terms of percentages, really in terms of dollars.
Yeah, they're probably still going, those higher rated players that you mentioned are probably still going to Horseshoe or maybe Ameristar, but they haven't quite made it over and stayed very often, I imagine, at the new Hard Rock Casino yet.
Oh, they'll be checking it out, or yeah, they will have checked it out. But you know, the existing casinos are kind of upping their offers and really upping their total game. And they know what these players like. You know, they know, okay, well, this woman likes free drinks. This guy likes a free steak. You know, for however much play, and they will go and market to where they believe they can get those players back in their properties, keep them in their properties, and increase their offers for a while to kind of make sure that they don't move over to the new property.
Right. We're talking with Ed Feigenbaum, who's the creator and the editor of the Inside Gaming Insight, I should say, Indiana Gaming Insight newsletter that is put out by the Hanna News Service. And if you will, Ed, reflect back on what you've seen and heard and read about the grand opening of the Hard Rock Casino Northern Indiana, and what you remember from and seen, of course, from the archives of how the other casinos here in Northwest Indiana, Ameristar and particular Horseshoe Casino in Hammond, how they managed to show off their wares on those opening days.
When you go back to when Horseshoe gravitated to its new gaming platform, left the old, you know, Empress Casino vessel, the numbers just kicked up by an incredible amount in the first month, that first July that they were open on the new platform. And we saw them take dominance not only in the Lake Michigan market, but statewide with that. You know, they topped the traditional market leader, the Argosy Casino in Lawrenceburg, the minute that they opened the new gaming platform. And then we also saw Ameristar get a pretty nice, pretty sizable lift from their ability to move some of their amenities, their gaming amenities, to the pavilion and to the hallway between the pavilion and the boat, and move their VIP area into that particular section on land. And they benefited from it. You know, it is no mistake to believe that if you do not invest, and maybe I'm saying that backwards, but if you invest in new amenities and you upgrade your property, if you make major changes, you are going to see a benefit in terms of a bottom line increase in your revenues.
Do you think that was probably also the case for Horseshoe Casino? That I know that the other casinos have they've all, I guess, done some changes, some additions, and upgrading their properties. And so I'm sure that Hammond was probably the same way too, right?
Yeah, and that's certainly why they made changes in their food amenities, moved some of that to the floor, changed around some of the locations of some of the machines and the blocks of machines. You know, you're constantly changing and evolving, and you know, they're going to have to compete against the new kid on the block here, as is everybody. And everyone's going to try and see, okay, well, what is it that Hard Rock is offering that we're not? How can we compete? You know, should we try to match them on this? Or should we simply try to, you know, up our game on something that we're doing very well and try to compete with the same kinds of players? One thing that I think is going to be real interesting to watch is the Baccarat marketing. And it looks like Hard Rock is doing a real strong job out of the gate in terms of attracting people who like to play that game. And, you know, that tends to be more of a game with an Asian kind of feel to it, attracting Asian patrons. And, you know, that had been something that Horseshoe had been real real strong on before, and I think that you're going to see, you know, some kind of competition in the market now for the baccarat player market.
Are we still concerned?
Looking at some kind of micro thing.
Are we still concerned about the possibility that the Chicago casinos are going to make some inroads and may have some impact on Hard Rock in particular, since it's the new guy in the block?
Yeah, absolutely. And we don't know what's going to happen with a new Chicagoland Southside casino. We don't know what's going to happen with a Chicago casino, whether that's going to be, you know, something downtown or, you know, more toward the south side. And we don't know anything more about the timing of that. I think we'll find out a little bit more this spring when Mayor Lightfoot's plans get finalized a bit and she sees some of the proposals from potential operators there. But that's still a ways down the road. And you're also going to have potentially a new operator in Hammond as well, you know, with the potential sale coming of the property by Caesars that's been forced divestiture by the Gaming Commission. And, you know, you're going to have another new operator in the market there as well. And then you look at the market leader right now, which is Rivers Casino in Des Plaines, and you realize that Rivers actually saw their revenues increase during the month of May. And one would have thought that, you know, some of their players would have also gravitated toward the Hard Rock property, you know, to check that out. And I think that goes to the point that I was trying to make earlier, Chris, and that's the, you know, we're seeing a lot of other factors here. You've got that post-pandemic push, the, you know, little bit of bump in the economy, people wanting to get out now that it's summer and do something and kind of make up for some lost time there. Because statewide, you know, we just had a tremendous month. We had $220 million in win, and that was the highest win statewide since March of 2018. And it was the best win that the state has seen in any May since 2012. And 2012 was the last month, essentially, that we're not competing against the four land-based casinos in Ohio. So, you know, there are all kinds of different things that factor into, you know, the revenues, and I think that's why it's way too early to see just what total impact you're going to have from Hard Rock.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple of minutes left, Ed, and I know we haven't checked in lately to find out what is the latest involving the court cases involving some of the well-known casino operators, people like the Ratcliffs and others from Spectacle Entertainment. What's the latest we're expecting to either know now or find out later from the courts?
Oh, gosh, you said a couple minutes, and we need a couple hours. There's going to be a Gaming Commission meeting toward the end of the month. I believe it's on the 24th, where they're going to be considering some more of the license issues for Spectacle, and particularly the Spectacle Terre Haute Casino. And Spectacle Terre Haute is, to a large extent, tied up with some of the ownership for Hard Rock, because it's a Spectacle entity that's involved in the ownership of the Gary Casino as well. And they're still fighting in court about whether some of the investors in the Spectacle project, principally now for Terre Haute, but also for Gary, will have to file disclosure statements with the Gaming Commission. And that fight, we thought we were going to have some clarity to it by June 4th. That's when the judge originally said he was going to decide. And then he said, well, I want to see some more filings from both sides. And we saw a few more filings, in fact, on Thursday and Friday of last week that the judge is going to have to sort through, some supplemental filings from both sides. And, you know, the sides just kind of refused to budge. The Gaming Commission says, hey, there's nothing to see here, you know. We've got some new regulations, and they're regulations that everybody's going to have to comply with, and they were enacted fairly and transparently, and we've got the authority to do it. And the plaintiffs in the lawsuit, the potential investors, the group that Spectacles brought in, you know, says, excuse us, but, you know, no, these rules were aimed at trying to, you know, force our sale, because everybody knew that we couldn't comply or didn't want to comply with them, and they can't do it that way, and they don't have the authority to do it. It's unconstitutional because it subjects us to criminal sanctions that the Gaming Commission can't undertake through administrative rules. And it's right now just a big mess.
Well,
so we'll see something toward the end of this week or early next week, I think, from the courts. And then it's in the hands of the Gaming Commission again.
Well, it sounds like we'll get back together again soon and bring up some of the latest you mentioned from the courts involving Spectacle Entertainment and people involved. And, of course, since you also take a look at the General Assembly, even though they're on a little summer vacation right now, they're going to be coming back to work here dealing with redistricting issues. And that's one thing I know that the Indiana Legislative Insight newsletter is going to cover as well. And we thank you for spending time with us to bring us up to date on the gaming industry here in Northwest Indiana and the rest of the state.
Always enjoy our visits and appreciate you having me, Chris.
You're welcome. Ed Feigenbaum is the creator and the editor of the Indiana Gaming Insight and the Indiana Legislative Insight newsletters from Hanna News Service. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Well, Father's Day is coming up, and maybe it's time to think of some things to do on Father's Day, aside from sitting watching television. Go out, get some fresh air. We can do so now, and the opportunity to check places out that might be of interest, including some places that have very special histories tinged to them here. And with us to talk about it, we have Times business reporter Joseph Pete, who's also, besides being an award-winning journalist, he is also, besides as well, being an infrequent guest here on Lakeshore Public Radio, he's an author. In fact, he's published a couple books. One of them is Lost Hammond, Indiana. And the latest one is called 100 Things to Do in Gary and Northwest Indiana Before You Die. And I suppose that also includes things to do during Father's Day weekend. And Joe, thanks for joining us to talk about it today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Chris. Well, oh, yes, it absolutely does. Packed with suggestions about ways to kind of be kind of a tourist in your own backyard in Northwest Indiana, and wonderful activities you could do with your father, whether, you know, a lot of family-friendly stuff, but, you know, if your dad likes baseball, it's filled with all the opportunities to kind of appreciate, you know, baseball in Northwest Indiana, ranging from, you know, the Rail Cats to the Northwest Indiana Oilmen, where you have the very unique opportunity to watch a, you know, baseball game against the backdrop of the flare stacks, the burning flare stacks of one of the largest oil refineries in the United States. It tells you about, you could take your dad for tours at the Hoosier Bat Factory in Valparaiso, or they've made wooden bats for many Major League superstars, such as Frank Thomas, Sammy Sosa, Don Mattingly. You can see how the bats have been made, take home one after the tour, visit the Mascot Hall of Fame, to learn about all the different mascots who, Ed Whiting, learned about all the different mascots who have kind of entertained crowds during the games over the years. One of the more unique ones, too, is I don't know if they have the game that weekend, but at the Deep River Water Park, it's kind of a hidden gem.
Wow.
The Deep River Grinders, they play vintage baseball in the 19th century style, where the kind of the original rules dating back to almost like the Civil War era, where they play without mitts and they use old-timey slang, and they play teams from across the Midwest, like the Chicago Salmon and, you know, touring teams, but it takes you back to the way baseball was originally played long before they introduced rules like, you know, the designated hitter or making it only 7 innings for a doubleheader, putting the runner on second. If your dad's grumbling about some of the changes, like putting the runner on second in the 10th inning, you know, you could take them back to see how the game like originally started before it, you know, really evolved. But it's just filled with, it's almost my love letter to the region. I'm from here. It's, you know, my home. I left and came back, and I just really appreciate Northwest Indiana and, you know, the wealth of things it has to offer. It often get overlooked in the shadow of Chicago and Indianapolis, but it's a truly special place with, you know, many beaches and many fun summer activities you could do with your father if he enjoys imbibing. It's got many suggestions for craft beer festivals.
That's true.
Breweries, meaderies, wineries, distilleries you can visit all across Northwest Indiana. Different things for every taste, whether he might prefer India pale ales or sour beers or, you know, that type of thing. And it gets into, you know, all the different restaurants you could potentially take him to celebrate that day. You know, it's a real celebration of region cuisine, everything from lake perch and frog legs to square cut pizza to all the Euro joints that are, you know, are scattered all across Northwest Indiana. And it's filled with, you know, restaurant suggestions for where to go to get lemon rice soup or, you know, kebabs or, you know, savapi or a lot of the cuisine that makes our, or that's arisen from us being such an ethnic melting pot and that makes our region so unique.
I know that you mentioned in the book about, of course, the Indiana Dunes National Park and the State Park, because it's a great place to enjoy the beach at Lake Michigan. But I guess if you can navigate your way through all the road construction work on Dunes Highway in Miller, you should probably check out Miller Woods. That's another great place and very quiet place, especially on a hot weekend, to check out the scenery and the wildlife there, I understand.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's one of the things I really sought to do in the book is kind of, you know, we have the 61st National Park. It's spectacular. It draws a ton of visitors. It's one of the fourth or fifth most biologically diverse in the entire country. Combined with the Indiana State Park, it's in like the top 10 nationally in terms of attendance. It's like right up there with, you know, some of the very big names, you know, like Yellowstone and so forth as far as visitors per year. When you add in the state park figures, it surrounds on all sides. But a lot of people just go straight to the beach. They go to the Indiana, they go to the beach at the Indiana Dunes State Park. They go to West Beach. They go to, you know, Mount Baldy and Lake Michigan. We have a lot of spectacular beachfront. We have an inland ocean. You don't have anything like that outside of the Gulf Coast, or outside of, you know, even the other Great Lakes don't really compare. If you go to like Cleveland or Toledo or Erie, Pennsylvania, you can see the other side of Lake Erie. Like, Lake Michigan stretches for more than 320 miles north-south. It's truly oceanic. It's really a vast expanse if you've never seen it. And that's wonderful. But there's so much more to our national park system here. It's very spread out. A lot of national parks you'll visit, like the Smoky Mountains or the Rocky Mountains, you just enter through the park, and there's one big park, and you can kind of, you know, hike or drive around it. But our park is spread out. It's spread out all across Northwest Indiana, mostly along the lakeshore. But there's just a ton of hidden gems in there, like the Tolson Dunes or Miller Woods especially.
Right.
It's one of my favorite hikes in the region because it really allows you to see it really puts the diversity of flora and fauna and of wildlife on full display. This was the area where the University of Chicago professor Henry Coles invented ecology. He was so struck by, you know, the variety of plant species living here that he allegedly jumped off a train to stop to kind of admire, to get a closer look and admire what was growing by the dunes. And that's really in full effect at the Miller Dunes. It's completely free. You can park there. It's near by the beach if you want to visit. But you take a hike and you go through these, like, you know, lagoons and ponds and black oak savanna where it's a mixture of prairie grasses and scattered trees to a more dense forest area. But some of the water, the inland water, is very striking because you have all these flowering plants growing in the water. It makes for some very dramatic photos you can put on Instagram. I regularly see all kinds of waterfowl, like ducks and herons are fishing in there. And, you know, I've gotten some dramatic pictures over the years, like deer on the ridge line as the sun is setting. And you can see beavers will, you know, go swimming in the Miller Lagoon. But you go hiking through this it's an extremely varied and diverse landscapes that you pass through. And then you come out to the Miller Lagoon, and then there are these towering, you know, sand dunes standing more than 100 feet high, and you're kind of walking at the edge of them. And eventually, after a couple miles, you make your way to the beach, and it's just a very dramatic reveal of the endless expanse of Lake Michigan lakefront. And you get to see some of the sort of like the tree graveyards where you have where the sand kind of shifted out from under the roots, and you have the dead trees jutting out of the sand, and there's driftwood, and it's just a lot of very striking visuals, great photo opportunities. If you or your dad enjoys nature, it's just an excellent hike that can't be beat. It really showcases, you know, all the varied landscapes our magnificent Indiana Dunes have to offer.
Now, Joe, I know that we talked about this, of course, before when we've talked about the books, both of them, as a matter of fact, but in particular for Father's Day, and you mentioned a lot of places that are good places to get away, to see a part of the planet of Earth that is just not like any place else when we're talking about the Indiana Dunes National Park and all of the wildlife areas that are close to Lake Michigan. But are there any places in particular you can recall that you and your dad may have seen and they may have accounted for in the book, for a matter of fact, but maybe not? Seems that he enjoyed the best when it's Father's Day to have a special time with him?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there are multiple, a lot of places in the book. Many places in the book were places I used to enjoy with my father. The Indiana Dunes beaches were one. We used to like to go down to Lemon Lake and Cedar Lake and hike around there.
Oh, yeah.
They have an excellent Halloween thing in the fall as well that they've been doing for years. But it also has a lot of the restaurants. I was with him growing up, like State Line Pizza and their Tavern Cut Pizza. And he was a big proponent of he loves Shoop's as well, but he likes Miner Dunn, and Highland was one of his favorite. Like, mm-hmm. It's classic vintage, started in Hammond many moons ago. As a classic vintage, now like 1950 style burger joint that specializes in the region burger, where it's big and beefy, but they make it it's griddled and it's very crispy on the outside. And it's not really well known outside of Chicagoland, but it's like very unique burger to our, to Northwest Indiana. And you have a few like old school places that really specialize in it here. And then, we always used to enjoy dining there. And then a lot of the stuff that I used to do with him when I was a kid really informs a lot of the work.
Well, it sounds like that you and your father have had great opportunities not only to have great meals, but to see some great sights along the way for Father's Day. And you've, as you mentioned, outlined some of these in your books, in particular, 100 Things to Do in Gary and Northwest Indiana Before You Die. And also the other book, The Lost Hammond, Indiana, some great points to catch up there. If you're more of a history buff, something to take Dad around to see for Father's Day. And Joseph Pete, who's an award-winning journalist for The Times and also the author of these books, thank you for spending time with us talking ahead of Father's Day about some great things to do. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. There's a renewed effort on college and university campuses to address the ongoing issue of hazing, with the recent death of a Western Ohio college student from alcohol poisoning during a frat party. A Central Indiana journalism professor emeritus is the author of a book entitled Hazing, Destroying Young Lives. And he spoke recently with NPR host Audie Cornish about how the Stone Foltz case could reshape hazing prosecution.
There were zero reported deaths from college hazing incidents in 2020, but the pandemic lull on campuses is fading, and six young men have been charged with manslaughter after a sophomore at Bowling Green State University died of alcohol poisoning at a fraternity party. It's the second hazing-related death this year. Experts like Hank Neuer are concerned that more may be on the way. He's an emeritus professor of journalism at Franklin College. He's written 5 books on hazing. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Can you give us just shortly the details of the Ohio case?
Well, Ohio's had several problems this particular year, but Stone Foltz died at Bowling Green State University. He was asked to drink a handle of alcohol, which amounts to 40 shots.
As I mentioned, several people have been charged in this case. And among those charges, there's involuntary manslaughter, hazing, obstruction of justice. How common are charges at all in these kinds of cases and these particular charges in this one?
There have been charges all along, but often they get dropped or they're unsuccessful. So I would consider this to be a landmark case because of the possibility of at least 5 years of imprisonment if the prosecutor is successful.
Can we dig into that a little bit more? Why is it common for these cases to be dropped or dismissed? What's going on legally?
Some states like Texas, doesn't matter if there's quote unquote consent of the victim. It doesn't matter, but other places it does. The other is we have 44 state laws out there on hazing, but some are very, very weak. And Ohio's is weak now, but they're trying to strengthen it after a death at Ohio University and now Bowling Green.
It's pretty clear the pandemic had an effect on all this, right? Because kids weren't around. They weren't on campus, and therefore there were zero deaths reported. Now that campuses are bringing students back, what do you expect to see?
Well, what I'm seeing is, in effect, we have 2 freshman classes in that the sophomores have been taking online classes. Now they're going to be out there and they haven't had any hazing or alcohol education programs. They're coming out there with a gusto because now they're the people of status who have power over these pledges, and then the regular freshman classes coming in, all excited as usual. And we've seen so many times where a death occurs in the first couple of days of the students on campus, sometimes before they've taken a single class.
We've been talking about this issue for years. What are some of the challenges that have really made it difficult to try and end fraternity hazing?
Well, in my opinion, campuses are the perfect storm for something like this because we're all about status and power. All of these obstacles have led to today when alcohol has been added to the mix. There wasn't a single death from alcohol before 1940. Now, it's one of the most major. There were 62 deaths from 2009 to 2021. 39 were alcohol related.
Finally, is this an opportunity for a reset for some of these campuses, some of these schools and universities? And what would that look like, especially given the constraints of the pandemic?
Okay, I want a hard approach. You have to go after the alumni who are encouraging this. You have to punish all of the hazing temporarily. This tradition has to stop, and it can't be looked at as tradition. As Mr. Dodson, the prosecutor, is doing in the Stone Folks case, you have to prosecute to the fullest extent.
That was Hank Neuer, an emeritus professor of journalism at Franklin College. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Marty.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.